Our guest on this edition of the podcast series is Glenn W. Bowersock, who is one of the leading ancient historians in all the Western world. And by ancient historian, that's not a comment on his age, though he is an emeritus at the Institute for Advanced Study at Princeton, New Jersey. But he is indeed universally understood to be a great illuminator of the nature of ancient civilization, not merely Greece and Rome, with which he began, but then the outlying territories in the ancient world, and the ancient world up to, say, the 7th century and the emergence of Islam. And indeed, about the emergence of Islam, we'll have a good deal to say, I think, tonight. The book in question, and it's the newest book by Glenn Bowersock, is titled The Throne of Adulis, Red Sea Wars on the Eve of Islam. I must, of course, begin, Glenn, by asking, who or what is Adulis?
This is a place near the Red Sea. It's just off the a little gulf that descends toward Aksum in Ethiopia, but is currently really a part of Eritrea. It was the port of Aksum, which was the capital city of Ethiopia, and now is not much of anything except it does provide an access into the highlands of Ethiopia. So basically it was an important port in antiquity where traders would go to exchange their goods bought from India or from the Persian Gulf, and we know they were involved with the ivory trade because there were a lot of elephants up in the highlands not far from there. So it was an important port, but it's nothing now. And
the relevance of the throne, I should say, incidentally, is not really that it's a throne, but it illuminates a good deal about something which lots of people don't know at all, namely a significant war between the Christians and the Jews.
Yeah, the throne is, in fact, a monument that has disappeared, but which is described in detail in antiquity by one of these visitors I was mentioning. And as you say, it provides documentation for events in two different periods. One, the Ptolemaic period, roughly third, second century BC, and the other in the Common Era, and it's the longer one, the more recent one of these two documents, which are inscribed on stone, that is the one that concerns me in this book because it involves an expedition across the Red Sea.
It is quite recent. It begins in 525 A.D., namely the invasion of what is now Yemen in southern Arabia or the southern Arabian Peninsula by Ethiopian forces. And they are on a kind of religious mission. They are indeed fighting over basic issues in religion. They are Christians ultimately Christianized from Byzantium, who are attacking Jews who rule a kingdom called Himyar, which is in, as I say, what is presently Yemen. Who in the world are the rulers of Himyar? How did they get to be Jews?
Well, let me just go back to finish on the throne, because the throne itself has a text that describes earlier invasions of South Arabia, of Yemen. And it was in the 520s that the ruler of Aksum wanted to use this and have it copied in order to justify the invasion that you've just described. That was an invasion that was partly religious. It was certainly Christians moving against Jews, no doubt about that, because the ancient sources are clear and these Christians were supported by the Christians in Byzantium. But it was also irredentist. That is to say, these Ethiopians had formerly been in this part of South Arabia, and they'd been dying to get the territory back again. And in a sense, this religious war provided an excuse for them to go back and take over the territory where they had once ruled before the Jewish kingdom of which you speak. Now, the Jewish kingdom was something relatively new in that part of the world. It came into existence toward the end of the 4th century of the Common Era, and it seems to involve a massive conversion of the Arab population, the indigenous population, to Judaism. Whether it also was inspired by or in connection with Jewish populations that were already there, and there were plenty of those too, both in the north and in the south, there's no way of telling. But it is clear that the kingdom by the early 5th century had become essentially a Jewish kingdom.
Now, these people on the Arabian Peninsula, at the south of it, are Arab in nature or in sort of cultural identity.
Yeah.
And they are, before converted to Judaism, they are what these days we would call pagan. This is before the rise of Islam. As many Jewish listeners, including the one who's talking with you now, there is some real surprise to discover that there was a Jewish kingdom at the south of the Arabian Peninsula.
Well,
how did it get established?
It is a real surprise, and as I try to point out in the book, there had been reports of this in literary sources. Greek ones and Arab ones, or ones in Arabic, which on the whole most people were disinclined to credit or to assume that what was being reported was a kind of vague monotheism or what used to be called in the old days Judaizing, but not really Jewish. It's only in the last 50 years that a lot of inscriptions have turned up in this region, with texts in Hebrew, with references to the people of Israel, that have persuaded the people working on this that this was a genuine and massive conversion to Judaism for a particular period. And this is borne out, and I would put some stress on this, by the fact that at Beit Sharim in Israel, where there are many tombs of Jews, there is one particular section that is reserved for the Jews of Himyar. And again, at an earlier stage, people assumed these tombs were earlier in date than the 5th or 6th centuries, but now the archaeologists, for quite independent reasons, have dated these tombs to the later period.
Is it now concluded as well by the relevant scholars that they had Judaism in full? They had the Hebrew Bible. They had the liturgy. They had the holidays. Were they, in fact, Jews as much as the Jews, say, of Rome, or for that matter, the Jewish remnant in Israel?
This is the consensus now. But when you say the holidays, I balk a little, because I can't recall any particular evidence for the holidays, but on most of the other points that you mention, there is documentation in the inscriptions. And so the nature of the conversion seems to be pretty well complete, though we don't have as much literary documentation. In fact, we don't have any. We're basically relying on stones, which have long documents, which are in Sabaean, which is the South Arabian language, and with Hebrew included, but also quotations from the Bible and, as I say, references to the people of Israel that have persuaded me and the people, particularly in France, where this has been studied in detail, that the conversion was pretty complete. But as I said earlier, the real question is the extent to which it was connected with prior existing Jewish communities. And we know there were some in the Hadramaut in the south, and we know there were, of course, near Mecca. It may be that there was a sort of mixing of these groups. I don't know.
And later on into the next century, we have in the Quran references to Jewish tribes around Mecca, or is it Medina?
Yes.
Who have trouble with Muhammad, though.
That's right.
He makes a temporary peace with them.
Yes, that's very interesting. Medina, what was then called Yathrib, had a very significant Jewish population, which I think many people believe, and I don't see any reason not to believe it, may have been a Jewish population that went there after Vespasian's destruction of Titus and Vespasian's destruction of the temple in the 70s. So these groups did run into trouble with Muhammad. And what's interesting to me is that in the early stage of his revelations, that a number of his supporters went off to Ethiopia and took refuge with the what was called the Negus, the king of Ethiopia. And I'm inclined to think this is a kind of reflection of the problems of the earlier part of the 6th century, the time of the invasions. It seems very odd that a bunch of supporters of Muhammad, who is in serious trouble with not only other religions, including the pagans, or the polytheists, as they were called, but the Jews, and many of his own people who resented what he was doing, that some of them should just decamp and go to Ethiopia. And I, again, that's a mystery, that, but it does seem to me to reflect something of what had been going on earlier, that they would go there. And there is in the Ethiopian tradition a report that the king or Negus of Ethiopia died on very good terms with Muhammad, and that Muhammad said a prayer on his behalf when he died. So there was quite a lot of this interaction of Ethiopian Christians, early unsettled, one might put it, unsettled Muslims, because they weren't yet Muslims. And as I'm sure you know, Muhammad had a lot of enemies among the other Arabs, who weren't just the pagans, but other monotheist Arabs at that time. And so it was a very, very volatile situation.
Coming back to the Jews, there have been in modern times Ethiopian Jews, sometimes referred to as the Falasha,
that
has some pejorative quality to it.
Yes,
most of them
know.
Have resettled in Israel. Indeed, a last few plane loads of Falasha Jews seems to have arrived in Israel only over the last month or so. Are they the products of late contact with Jewish Ashkenazic Jews who converted them, or are they, or Sephardic Jews who converted them, or were they Jewish back that far in history?
This is a highly controversial matter that I don't really feel competent to pronounce on, but I will say that there are many people that I know and respect who would not want to consider the Falashas as Jews in any traditional or deeply rooted sense. And if I remember right, didn't the parliament in Israel have to pass a special measure to allow?
Well, there was some struggle over it. The original Europeans who discovered the Falasha only sometime in the 19th century reported that they considered themselves Jews, and they had the five books of Moses. That was all the sacred texts they had, strangely.
Yeah.
And their religious practice was somehow adapted to or somehow imitative of Ethiopic Christian practice. But they were distinctive in that world and viewed as a distinct group.
Well, one of the odd things about Ethiopian Christianity, well, I shouldn't say odd, but one of the remarkable things about Ethiopian Christianity is that it claims to be descended from Solomon. And they think, or at least they claim to have the Ark of the Covenant sitting in Aksum. So there is.
Oh, that's where it is then.
That's where it is. It was. It went there by supersonic transport, apparently at an early stage. The relation between Falashas, Jews, and the Christians themselves, who have these alleged Solomonic roots, is very hard to make out. And so when you ask me about the Salashas, I really don't feel in a position to say anything other than I'm aware that there is a serious issue. Well,
back to South Arabia then. Well, back to South Arabia and the war between the Ethiopic Christians and the Arab Jews of Himyar. How did that war play itself through?
Well, the Caleb, he was called. He took this biblical name, the Christian king of Aksum, was a very good military man and a good commander, and he arranged the expedition in a way that apparently was able to overcome the army of the Himyarite Jews. There are a number of legendary stories about people riding through the sea, and I mean, you can't tell what is genuine, but he seems to have fought the war quite effectively, but the problem is the moment he defeated the Himyarite Jews, the Christians that were left behind started fighting with each other, and that set up a whole new dynamic that caused increased confusion in that region. It was a cauldron. Even before 525, which you mentioned, there had been a 3 to 4 year period in which the Jewish kingdom had been replaced by a Christian kingdom that seems to have been installed there by the Ethiopians, but it didn't last very long. So as I said earlier, it was extremely volatile. But when the Christians were there, they obviously did a good job from a military point of view, and then they started fighting with each other. Part of the problem was that some of these Christians wanted to stay because they thought it was a nice place to live.
Yeah.
And this was not what the Ethiopian king expected. He expected them all to go back.
I was about to say that a basic continuing theme in historic materials, sometimes well developed by historians, is the relation between politics and state politics and religion. Gibbon, of course, and I know you've done a whole book on Gibbon, is tremendously interested in Christianity and the fall of Rome.
Yes.
And indeed, to oversimplify Gibbon tremendously, he in a way blames the fall of Rome, which he dates to somehow the 15th century, the fall of Constantinople. The fall of Rome, he says, is essentially, ultimately, traceable to the influence of Christianity.
Well, I've written about this. So the Gibbon, when he started, intended to stop in the 5th century. And there is a moment of repose in his Decline and Fall in which he talks about the decline of the West. And that was where he was going to end. And then he decided that the story went on. And so he picked up the project again and carried it through to the fall of Constantinople in the 15th century. And in a sense, he started with the decline and fall of Rome, and then the decline kept going on and on and on. And I think he didn't know quite what to do. But anyway, this was not his original plan.
No. And the overall book is the decline of West Rome, and after that, the decline of East Rome,
yes,
which takes another 1,000 years or so.
Well, that's right. Yeah, and the East and the West, when they went their separate ways, really did go their separate ways. So I've just been thinking about there's a scholar in London who thinks that that Byzantium was terribly important in keeping the Muslims from going into Europe, and she may be right about that. But as you know, French scholar Pirin argued that Mohammed had a lot to do with Charlemagne becoming the person he was by the Muslim invasion of North Africa, creating a context for the rise of Charlemagne.
I am
all of these things have repercussions across the whole Mediterranean region. And it's fascinating. And anyway, I'm sorry to interrupt you.
Now, I'm very interested in history. I read in it a fair amount, though I'm totally amateurish. But I've also poked around in the philosophy of history, and I was always very impressed by the maxim, the orders given by Leopold von Ranke, who is in a way the father or the schoolmaster of modern historiographic method. He says,
well, at least the method that you and I approve of. I agree.
Yes.
I mean, there are a lot of people who don't approve of what Ranke. You were talking about the Wies eigentlich gewesen doctrine.
He says, alles erzählen, wie es eigentlich gewesen war. Tell everything the way it really was, it really happened.
Well, I'm behind him on that.
But is it possible to do that for an obscure war fought in the south of Arabia in the 6th century?
It is within limits. Obviously, you work with what you have, and we have a lot more than we had even 40 years ago. And its history is an ongoing enterprise, and what could be said 50 years ago is very different, or was very different from what we can say now. And when we talk about how it really was, we have to simply work with what we've got. But what had not been possible before was to do this solely on the basis of historiography written centuries after these events happen. What I think Ranke would approve of in this case is that we actually have contemporary documents and material, so we're not dependent on somebody writing in Baghdad 200, 300 years later. I think that's a step forward, and I think if Gibbon were around, he would find that very interesting too.
But let me share the extent of my preoccupation with you. It seems to me that in a way, von Ranke wouldn't be satisfied even with what contemporary historians do with the history of recent major events. For example, World War II. What caused it, and why did it work out the way it did? There is even in England itself, as well as, to be sure, in Germany and elsewhere, there are a number of different theories as to the origins of the war.
Absolutely.
The nature of the war. One of the great English historians was A.J.P. Taylor.
I know. I knew A.J.P. Taylor.
And he took a totally different view of the very origins of the war and why it happened. Also in the process arguing it need not have happened. It was a mistake to get in, which is, if that's a Ranke judgment, it's an unusual one, to say the least.
Well, I was there in Oxford when Taylor and Trevor Roper were fighting with each other. And it was partly a personal battle, but it was also a battle of principle over how you do history. And I had enormous respect for Taylor, not least because, in a Rankean sense, he really knew everything and tried to work from what he knew. Somebody like Trevor Roper worked with a much, what should we say, broader brush and tried to see sort of large forces and principles at work. And that's not bad either, but obviously many of us are drawn to where the evidence is, and to that extent, I think Taylor was onto something. Whether he's right about the Second World War, I wouldn't presume to say, but I certainly thought he was right to say it.
When you say you wouldn't presume to say whether he was right, what you are implicitly also confirming is that history is not a science and is essentially a matter of informed interpretation, but always interpretation.
I couldn't agree more. I'm sure that's exactly what it is. It's not a science. It's not an art either. It is interpretation is the right word. And as I said earlier, we simply have to do our best with what we have. But fortunately, one good thing about this enterprise is that we keep having more material. New material keeps turning up. For modern historians, they get it through the opening up of archives, the opening archives in Russia after the fall of the Soviet Union was a tremendous opportunity for historians working on that. I know a number of young people who went there and found fabulous material. And that I think is what makes history so exciting. It doesn't stay the same precisely because what we work with doesn't stay the same.
Well, now let me come to the history of the origins of Islam. And we've mentioned Fadalanka a few times. Here's another quotation from him. He says, "In school books and in literature, we can separate ecclesiastical and political history. In the life of mankind, they are intertwined." Mm-hmm. Ecclesiastical and political history.
Mm-hmm.
Let us look at Islam and its origins, both in ecclesiastic and in political terms.
Well, I fully agree with that. I think ecclesiastical and political are constantly involved, though one has to be careful in talking about the politics of the ecclesiastical organization and the politics outside the ecclesiastical organization. With Islam in its earliest phases, the politics both were directed to external forces such as Byzantium or the Persians, particularly Byzantium and the Persians. That's one aspect of the political situation, but also the political situation within the Arab communities in Mecca and Medina, where Muhammad was trying to put his revelation together. And there is politics about that too. And it seems to me that very remarkable that the Quran says that that Abraham, for example, was not a pagan, he was not a Jew, he was not a Christian. And one might well ask, if he wasn't any of these things, what was he? I think this is a debate that that still goes on. But what the Quran says he was a Hanif in Arabic. And this is the very same word or root that is used to mean an apostate in many Semitic languages. This is the word that's applied to Julian as an apostate. But clearly in the Quran, it's a very good thing to be a Hanif. And we know, there's been a very interesting discussion among the early Islamic historians, and particularly a wonderful scholar in Jerusalem, that Hanif has a double meaning. It means a person of perfect right judgment and persuasion, and the opposite, the same word. So the enemies of Muhammad were called Hanif, and the supporters of Muhammad were called Hanif. And if this isn't politicization inside the nascent Islamic movement, I don't know what is. And I don't know what the answer to this is either, except that in those early years when Muhammad was still alive, there was a lot of fluidity and uncertainty. And it's perfectly true that it was as much political as it was religious.
Well, I want to ask you now, if I may, to summarize what modern scholarship on the Quran and on the early years of Islam and on its emergence, its invention, has realized, or at any rate, what is the consensual view? Beyond the consensus by far, but still something which gets some attention these days, is a new school, maybe it's 30 or 40 years old, which argues that the existence of the historical Muhammad is in itself uncertain,
yes,
and he may never
that.
Have been there. Just mm-hmm. as earlier we had similar speculations about the historical Jesus, mm-hmm. until Schweitzer, over 100 years ago, wrote his book on the search for the historical Jesus.
Mm-hmm.
What is the general, I know that this is not the sole area or the main area in which you've worked, that is the emergence and further flowering of Islam, but from all of your colleagues who worked on that, what is the emerging image? The emerging story, as it were.
Well, I would say it's still emerging. There is certainly a contingent out there. I have a colleague here at the Institute who has worked on this at various stages, Patricia Crona, who together with a colleague published a book on Hagerism a good many years ago, looking for the Jewish roots of Islamic thought. And this is perfectly reasonable and right, because there are so many connections. Whether it means that Muhammad can be wiped out, as some have suggested, that he's just a name for something that was going on rather than a person, or whether, as was suggested about 6 months ago in a book, Muhammad didn't even live in Mecca, but was in the south of Jordan somewhere near Petra. I mean, I would reject that altogether, but I think that there is a great deal of uncertainty about the extent to which Muhammad's revelation was, could I say, tradition, handed down or inherited from other Semitic cultures, and the extent to which it was a wholly new revelation. And I think that is still open to argument. I've had a lively debate with Patricia, my colleague here, about whether the pagans were really pagans at the time of Muhammad. She's now convinced that all the so-called pagans were in fact monotheists. I don't think I believe that, but it shows the uncertainty of what we know and the varieties of the discussions that are going on. In a sense, the years from, what shall we say, about 600 down to 622, and maybe a decade after that, are so fluid and so unclear that, I mean, there are some indications that Muhammad might have been interested in making common cause with the Byzantines. There's Michael Lecker in Jerusalem thinks that at one stage he was actually looking to the Greeks in Constantinople for help. Again, I don't think we can prove this, but it's something worth thinking about.
Well, if you think about the founding story or founding myth, if you think about of the actual beginning of the Quran, what we have, or at the beginning of the story told in the Quran, what we have is this illiterate camel driver who wanders into a cave to contemplate or for whatever, and there he encounters the angel Gabriel, who orders him recite.
Right.
And he says, "I cannot recite. I do not know the texts. I am illiterate." And Gabriel insists, "Recite." And again, he says, "I cannot." And Gabriel puts his arms about him and squeezes him, as if he were doing the Heimlich maneuver, as we call it today. And yeah, out come the first words of the Quran.
Yeah.
What reality, if any, lies behind that? Or what are they doing by that elaboration of the origins of the Quran? What's the political reality behind it?
Well, the political reality, in terms of the ecclesiastical or the religious political reality, is that the Quran is the divine word of God, as transmitted,
yes,
to Muhammad by Gabriel, and cannot be altered. Now, this is, to me, of the greatest interest, because there's no text that comes from anywhere, anytime, that doesn't get corrupted as it goes along. And yet, until very recently, it was impossible even to suggest emendations in the text of the Quran. But as you may know, this situation arose some centuries back in the time of Erasmus, when nobody wanted to emend the text of the New Testament. And I think that what has happened in recent decades that is very good is that people are being much more flexible about the text of the Quran. In other words, recognizing that this is a text with variants that can be dealt with in different ways. And as you may know, for the first time, we have very early texts of bits of the Quran that have turned up in Sana'a in Yemen. Until very recently, it was thought that the earliest text of the Quran that we actually possessed was on the Dome of the Rock. But that is no longer the case, and we now are seeing texts of the Quran that are so early and that show variants. So I think we're on our way to getting at least a really scholarly, balanced assessment of this text, rather what happened to the New Testament some centuries ago, where now people don't hesitate to talk about variants. Or indeed in biblical criticism, where there.
Well, we spoke of Gibbon before. In a way, he gives the challenge, and I think I might use this quotation as the basis for the remainder of our conversation, which I am trying to structure on the question of the origins and the evolution of Islam. Mm-hmm. Gibbon says, "The theologian may indulge the pleasing task of describing religion as she." He feminizes religion. I'll start again. "The theologian may indulge the pleasing task of describing religion as she descended from heaven, arrayed in her native purity. Okay. A more melancholy duty is imposed on the historian. He must discover the inevitable mixture of error and corruption which she contracted in a long residence upon earth among a weak and degenerate race of beings."
Well, I have no quarrel with that.
But what then is the outcome? What do we now really have to say about not merely the origins of Islam, but then its rapid spread through the Middle East and beyond, even into Europe, even into the Iberian Peninsula, and the changes it's gone through down to the present day, and its present fundamentalist section, which is rather regressive towards the West?
Yes, very.
What is to be said about Islam?
Well, I think in those early years, and I agree entirely with your quotation or with Gibbon, as you quoted, there was an extremely fluid situation. We know that the early caliphs, some of the early caliphs, actually worshipped in Christian churches. There was a good deal of trading back and forth. Though I don't know of any of this with the rabbis or the rabbinical schools, and this is interesting. When Muhammad wanted or thought of making common cause with the Greeks, with the Byzantines, I think possibly because of the troubles with the Medina Jews, he didn't look in that direction. And I think that is, as I try to point out in the book, has a lot to do with the fact that the Persians were great supporters of the Jews in the time of Muhammad, and at the time they captured Jerusalem in the early 7th century. And obviously, I think Muhammad was not interested in joining with the Persians. The relation between what happened then, which I think was very fluid and at one stage could have gone any number of different directions, it really only settled, as a friend of mine used to say, until the middle, not until the middle of the 7th century. There was so much fluidity in political and religious alliance. It was when the Persians were wiped out, they finally came to an end about the middle of the 7th century, the Persian Empire did, that a new configuration began to take shape, and the Muslim caliphs, the Umayyads, which then took over, began to impose Arabic and impose Islam in a kind of strict way. And to my mind, it's at this point that the kind of aggressive conservatism that lingers on so widely now was laid down, was started. And that, of course, was carried across North Africa and into Spain, but not into Europe. And if my friend in London is right, partly because the Byzantines were able to keep off the Muslim navy when it tried twice to take Constantinople.
Except, of course, we have the Muslims of Albania and and Bosnia-Herzegovina, who are converted to Islam and stay with Islam, though their conversion probably occurs much later.
Much later, I think. I don't know a lot about that, but you're absolutely right. They're there, and but just as, you know, they are in Europe now. I mean,
well, in Europe, they've recently come in as immigrants, of course.
They have, but they're. I mean, in Holland and Germany, they're a very remarkable and worrying force.
A great question along those lines, really relating to the study of religion generally, is whether insistence upon fundamentals and on the purity of the original scriptural sources and the severe demands that God imposes on us, whether that is asserted in Christian terms or in Jewish Orthodox terms or in Salafist Orthodox Islamic terms, whether that is sort of an inevitable turn that religion takes when it's been somewhat modernized, that nativist forces reassert what is the good old religion and act aggressively in support of the good old faith.
Well, that's a terrific question or point. I mean, I think that there is, at least in all the religions that I know about, and I don't know about the East Asian ones, but this kind of conservatism that tries to recover the fundamental principles of the founding people does tend to be a kind of reaction to dislocations, defeats, or other kinds of disturbances in the religious and political order. I think that you're absolutely right about that, that there is a tendency to do this. I mean, here in America, one sees a very great distinction between the Christians of the South and the Christians in other places.
Yes, in fundamentalist churches and evangelical settings in the South particularly, there's a gospel tune which still flourishes. Give me that old-time religion.
That's right.
Give me that old-time religion. It was good enough for the prophet Joshua. It's good enough for me, because Joshua was not a Christian.
Yeah, and the problem is that if you say, I don't want the old-time religion, in certain areas you're considered a traitor or a heretic or something that isn't going to be good for you. And,
of course, we see that, don't we, in contemporary Islam, forgetting it's...
Indeed we do. Oh, absolutely, in spades.
We see it, for example, in Egypt right now on the
question of what the Muslim I mean, this the Egyptian situation is a very, very good example of that. And we add to it the political desire on the part of other countries, particularly this one, to support democracy. And then if a democracy doesn't produce the results you're happy with, you're in trouble. And this was the case with the Palestinian elections. And it goes back, I mean, with the Greeks, with which I began my career, the Athenians thought that they had a great mission to spread democracy. But if they spread democracy and the people who were elected didn't do what they wanted them to do, then they wipe them out. And that's a problem that that Egypt now shows very, very clearly. I think this is part of a historical process. I don't, you know, want to generalize too much, but history never stands still. And that, I think, is very disturbing to people who wish it would stand still.
There's a view of history which is rather cynical and enunciated by various people we know. When you were at Oxford, did you ever encounter A.L. Rouse?
I did. I actually encountered him quite a lot. I found him insufferable, but interesting.
Yes, lots of people did. I met him later in his life.
Yeah.
He says, history is a great deal closer to poetry than is generally realized. In truth, yeah, I think it is in essence the same. Added to that, I'm going to offer you a handful of quotations I've got before me. All of them rather cynical about the possibility of doing serious history. Napoleon says, history is a myth that men agree to believe. Yet others say similar things. Is it possible, John F. Kennedy said something like that. He said, the victors write the history.
Well, that's been said by lots of people.
And
that's led, as you know, I'm sure, to a very, very wide fashion of writing history from the ground up. And so you would write sort of history of hairdressers and the history of rat catchers and the history of chimney sweeps and so on.
That would be the Annalist school.
Exactly, exactly.
Yes.
And, you know, all of this contributes something, though I think that was an extreme reaction. It was a very noticeable reaction. History is just an ongoing process or an ongoing struggle. But as I said, one does the best one can with what one has. And the fact is, what one has changes every day. And that makes it exciting. It also makes it unstable.
I once asked a friend of mine who was here at the faculty of the University of Chicago and a specialist in 18th century French history up to and including the Revolution. He knew everything in that realm and always fascinated me as a conversational partner. And I once said to him, aren't you ever frustrated with the thought that, the 18th century as well in France as well or better than life here and now? Don't you ever wish you could be there and live there? To which his answer was, good God, no, they didn't have dental anesthesia.
Well, I sympathize very, very much with that, and I've had similar conversations with Bob Darnton, who knew all this French 18th century, early 19th century very,
yes,
very well, and he never wanted to be there. And I certainly wouldn't want to be in Augustan Rome, I can tell you that, or Periclean Athens, where there was widespread slavery and oppression of women. I mean, I often think that with the people who advocate the Athenians as the founders of democracy, they forget that that Pericles is reported to have said by Thucydides that the best thing for women is never to open their mouths, never to say anything.
Yeah. Well,
and, I mean, this is not my idea of a democracy.
Even from Socrates, as reported by Plato, we tend to get some condescension towards women, don't we?
Oh, we do. We do. I do. Yeah. Very eloquent he is, but the sentiments are not all that attractive. And I think it's important to recognize the progress we've made at the same time as the danger of regression and the models that we admire are treacherous ones. I guess what I'm pleading for is the complexity of both past and present and the need to be constantly reassessing it. Constantly.
You know, I'm suddenly imagining, this is a pure flight of fancy and a touch on the irresponsible side, I'm imagining a senior historian and a young apprentice pursuing his doctorate, say in the year 3000, at what university, I'm not sure, perhaps even at the Institute for Advanced Study. The young fellow says to the older one, gee, you know so much about the 20th and 21st centuries. Don't you ever wish that you could live there? What would he answer?
I hope in 3000 that he would say, no, I don't want to live there.
Why not?
Well, I can't tell you because I don't know what life is going to be like in 3000, but I have never known of any time in the past that I wanted to retroject myself into. I just don't know. I mean, I find it all extraordinarily interesting and very important to study and constantly relevant to what we confront now. But I never for a moment wanted to go back in time, even in my own life. I wouldn't like to go back to when I was 20 years old.
Well, partly it's a matter, surely, of technology. Whatever they thought they had technologically, it wasn't as good as what we've got now.
But, well, I suppose there's something to that. So, and I constantly during the hot summers crosses my mind that when I was a boy, and I guess you were a boy, that there was no air conditioning.
Uh-huh.
And now I don't know what I'd do without it. But,
yes.
But one managed perfectly well. I remember somebody said to me, "What did you do?" I said, "I drank lemonade."
That's not a bad answer.
But that's what I did. I think it is an ongoing process, both writing history and living.
You are emeritus at the Institute, yes. But still obviously very busy working and writing. The Throne of Adulis, Red Sea Wars on the Eve of Islam, is just recently published by Oxford University Press. What are you working on now?
What I'm trying to do now is to put together a book that brings what we've been talking about right now all together. I tentatively called it The Crucible of Islam. I have a contract to deliver this, but at the moment, it's still a mass of notes. But I'd like to give some sort of clarity to the mess, to the complexity that I've been explaining to you, so as to break down the either or interpretation of these years from, as I said, about 570 to 650, which I think are when so much changed and happened. And it could have gone a different direction every time.
And isn't that the fascinating thing in history, that if you make a little change in one or another variable, everything from that point forward might have been quite different.
Absolutely, absolutely. And this is what I'd like to do with that kind of transitional period.
Yes.
I mean, because the world, and perfectly reasonably, assumes that you go, you know, from antiquity to Islam. Even Gibbon, I think, felt that this was a kind of curtain that came down and a new era began. My view is just the opposite, that it was a kind of a twilight zone in which all sorts of things were changing and happening, and you didn't really know what was going to come out of it until about 50 years later.
Well, Glenn Bowerstock, talking with you is as fascinating as reading you. anyone who wants to read your latest work, The Throne of Adulis, that is published by Oxford University Press. And I thank you most sincerely for joining us this afternoon.
Well, it's been a great pleasure, and I've enjoyed talking to you. Thank you.
Excellent. Hope we'll do it again soon.
Okay. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye now.